Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Daily Drum. I'm Harold Fisher.
As you've heard the chief say, the people that we are arresting primarily, especially for the crime of armed carjacking, the one that has had our community almost literally under siege. None of us feel safe. I don't feel safe stopping at a gas station to get gas. If these are children, if they are 14, 15, and 16 years old, where are their parents? It's a fair question.
That's Prince George's County Executive Angela Osselbrook speaking just yesterday about the scourge of juvenile violence in our community. Tomorrow is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. But do we really need an official day to make us aware of the national epidemic of gun violence? We see it every day on our streets. Reported in the news. It is a kitchen table conversation. What we really need are solutions. Well, tonight at this insight segment table, we will hear some. My guests are Dr. Roger Mitchell, co-chair of the Howard University Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, and Marcus Ellis, executive director of Peace for DC, a gun violence reduction organization. Lines are open. Give us a call. What do you think? What do you believe are the solutions to the problem? Give us a call at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at H Fisher, WHUR, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Mitchell, good to see you again.
It's great to see you, Harold. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Marcus, thank you so much for coming into the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Mitchell, let me first ask you, you would have to be living under a rock to not to see the problems that are plaguing our community across the DMV as well as nationally. Why do you think this is such a growing problem?
Well, it's been a problem for a long time, and I think that if we understand that, you know, gun violence is different in different places throughout the country. A lot of the times it comes to the American consciousness through active shooters. We spend a lot of time talking about it when it's an active shooter, and that's why these conversations, when we're talking about urban smoldering violence, violence in African-American communities and poor communities, when we're having these types of conversation, when there's, you know, single, two, three people that die because of gun violence, and having these conversations about solutions is extremely important. When we're talking about these violence that happens in community, we're often talking about a symptom of access. And so I come from a background of violence as a public health issue, and thinking about access as a solution to behavior. So when I talk about access, I'm talking about W.E.B. Du Bois's areas of influence and policy, which is education, economics, housing, healthcare, and non-disparate criminal justice practices. And so when we don't have those things in community, right, and families are suffering from those inequities, then the human behavior will often allow for us to resolve conflict with violent behavior. So that's not the full solution, which really is a cover for institutional racism. So that's not the full reason why we are engaging in violence, and violence is a problem in our community. But quite frankly, we have issues in our community largely because of the access that we might not have to those five major areas.
You know, Marcus, we have seen just this week in Prince George's County, we've seen in the District of Columbia, we have seen in Northern Virginia some really horrific examples of very young people. Very, very young people, an 11-year-old arrested in D.C. for a mini crime wave, a 12-year-old in D.C. arrested for a mini crime wave, armed robbery in both of these cases, examples today of prepubescent black boys committing violent crimes at the point of a gun. What do you believe is responsible and for these kinds of things? And where do these very young children get these guns?
Yeah, you know, when we started this work prior to serving as executive director for Peace for D.C., I was doing work under the mayor's office. And when we started that gun violence prevention work just about 6 years ago, we were really focused on a population of 18 to 35. That's where the data was leading us. And so that's what we were addressing. I think that what we know is that we have a cycle of gun violence. And the cycle will not just stop itself, right? We need interventions. We have to have strategies that are proven and data-driven, or else this is what we're going to see, right? And so we can look at different points in time. We can look across the nation. And these things tend to vary in terms of who is committing the crime, right? But we are obviously seeing a trend in the District of Columbia where we're getting younger, not just the District of Columbia, but the DMV as a whole. And when you talk about the ability to receive a gun, they're in our communities just like the candy stores are. And sometimes, unfortunately, the guns are at the candy store, right? There are a variety of ways. We have to look at this in terms of our borders, what we're seeing coming over from Virginia and other states. And we got to get some controls around that. Myself and Dr. Mitchell were speaking to another colleague, Greg Jackson, earlier about this issue as it pertains to the ATF and their assignment to cut down on some of these illegal guns that are making their ways to our communities. And so a lot of times we had this conversation about investments in policing. Well, ATF is one of the agencies that is being underfunded. And this is their job to figure out where these guns are coming from. And so, you know, it's not a new problem. It's unfortunately a problem that has plagued urban communities for quite some time. And it's something we really have to get a hold of.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about possible solutions to address the gun violence issue in our community, particularly as it relates to young people. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. George, calling from Northwest D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I think a solution for gun violence is to put more emphasis on a spiritual life for our young people. That's my comment.
Okay. George, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Dennis, calling from D.C. Yeah. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I believe it's not so much of the guns. The guns come in with bullets. So the thing is, you have to get rid of these bullets. Only issue bullets to, like, police officers, military, people that are supposed to have bullets. And then it should be on file and records where the bullets going to, how many they issue to, so many police officers, and everything. Every time you go on a crime scene, it's not the guns they find at the crime scene or people dying from the guns, it's the bullets. If you slow down on the bullets and they can't get bullets, then it's nothing that a gun can do.
Yeah. Okay, Dennis. Okay, let me stop right there, Roger, because first of all, a gun without bullets doesn't work. A bullet without guns doesn't work. But the reality is that both of them are on the street. And he's talking about the legal regulation of firearms and ammunition.
That's right.
That's a different conversation.
Well, I think it's part of the conversation. So, you know, he got to it, you know, talking about bullets. And we've been talking about technology that only allows for a single individual that owns a gun to be able to discharge the weapon that they purchased, right? We know that right now, if you pick up your cell phone, you either have to use your thumbprint or your facial recognition to be able to operate that cell phone. And so we know that there's technology to make this cell phone mine and to unlock it. That technology can be applied to firearms, quite frankly, and has been applied to firearms. But it would make it too expensive for the manufacturers of guns to be able to produce them and then be bought, and it will make them functionally too expensive for individuals to buy them. So it's a capital issue for the gun manufacturers to limit how they make guns safe. So I'm extrapolating on his bullet construct just to show that there is technology to limit how you can discharge a weapon to its owner. The other piece that I think he's getting to is what Marcus talked about, is that we have gun show loopholes. And we have loopholes that allow for straw purchases, people that can go in and buy these guns legally and then go across a state border and then sell them illegally. And the ATF has full knowledge. There's full knowledge law enforcement has of where the guns are coming from the where they were purchased as a function of those gun shows, as well as where they're purchased at the gun shops. But there's lack of enforcement of moving guns across borders. Controlling guns, and people don't like the word gun control, but controlling access to guns is definitely a part of, and the munitions is definitely a part of a larger strategy for gun violence prevention in community.
But there's also ghost guns. And as we saw in the shooting in the bathroom at the high school in Montgomery County earlier this year. Young people, adults, people who want to commit crimes and get guns, and I'm not saying that your argument is not valid, but all of those things are kind of thrown out the window because it apparently if they want to get their hands on guns, they do. So what, in the work that you do, you know, Marcus, what kind of solutions are you trying to come up with? What kind of work are you doing with your organization, Peace for DC?
Absolutely. And so if I could just piggyback on something that Dr. Mitchell mentioned, you know, when we're looking at these crime scenes, you're not finding 3, 4, 5, 6 shells. You're finding hundreds of shells,
exactly.
Right? And so
yes.
That level of weaponry, it definitely has an impact because what you're seeing more and more is that unfortunately we want the shooting to stop. But what we're seeing is folks that aren't at all the target of the shootings are being killed. And that has a lot to do with the amount of ammunition that's coming out of that firearm. We look at this work from a different lens, right? At Peace for DC, one of the things we aim to do is invest in what we call peacemakers. We obviously know that for years, this country has focused on policing efforts to stop violent crime. We obviously know that as standing by itself, that has not worked. And so we have peacemakers or violence interrupters, as they're often called, credible messengers that come to our academy, and we're working on a couple of things, not just honing in on their skill sets to do this very important work, to be able to convince someone who was about to commit the act of using a gun to put that weapon down through nothing but their relationship, their credibility, and their connection to their community, but we're also helping them build out their professional resume so we can start to look at, okay, after this, what's next for you? Mm-hmm. When we had periods in, I think it was 2011, when our homicides dropped to around 88, and the violence prevention funding went away, and folks really didn't have an option that were in that work. And so we want to make sure that, one, we keep the funding coming. We definitely want to make sure we do that. But in the meanwhile, we also want to make sure that our violence interrupters, peacemakers, have a career path. And it's very, very important work they're doing.
Stay with us because we're also going to hear what Dr. Roger Mitchell is doing here at Howard University in conjunction with this look, this pursuit of peace on the streets in D.C., gun violence reduction. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're going to be talking to Colette calling from Suitland, Walter calling from Maryland, Paul calling from Capitol Heights, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. If you're on the phone, don't hang up. You will be able to hear the conversation, and we will talk to you next. Also, if you're having difficulty getting through, because our lines are loaded right now, please keep trying. We want to hear from you as well. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. This conversation continues on SiriusXM Channel 141 in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our conversation about strategies to fight gun violence. My guests are Dr. Roger Mitchell, co-chair of the Howard University Gun Violence Prevention Task Force, and Marcus Ellis, executive director of Peace for DC, a gun violence reduction organization. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Certainly you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Marcus, I want to get back to you in just a bit, but also, you know, Dr. Mitchell, what role is Howard University playing in trying to address this issue?
So the president set up a task force about a year ago, mm-hmm. On gun violence prevention. And the dean of the School of Law, the dean of social work, and myself were asked to co-chair it. There's several professors and students that are on this task force. And this task force is looking to develop curriculum at first. What we've realized is that there has been a lack of understanding on gun violence and violence prevention and tactics across disciplines like law, social work, behavioral disciplines, public health, medicine, political science, to ensure that we are educating the future of violence prevention advocates and experts in the space. One of the things that we're doing with the Peace Academy is we helped develop the 120-hour curriculum. We supported that curriculum, vetted that curriculum, and now are looking to support that curriculum so that it can be somewhat of a credit for these violence interrupters here at Howard University. We're also working with the Peace Academy and Peace for DC to help assess and evaluate the program, right, to make sure that it's impactful. What are the true outcomes of this learning environment that they're creating for their peacemakers or violence interrupters? And so all of this type of academic type of research support is extremely important. We also use resources at the Center of Excellence for trauma and violence prevention here at Howard University to support hospital-based violence interrupters. Hospital-based violence interrupters, if someone comes in with a stabbing or a shooting, a violence interrupter who's placed in the emergency department goes to that individual and asks them, what is it that you need? What is it that's going on in your home? Now, understanding that they're victims of violence, right? But often the victims of violence today can be the perpetrator of violence tomorrow. And also there's a recidivism of individuals who get shot. So often when they come to the emergency department, that might not be the first time that they've encountered a shooting. And so we create wraparound services to those individuals that find them victims. We are able to identify who amongst their friend group may be thinking about retaliation. And so we try to form relationships right there. Right there, they're vulnerable to having conversations about how life can change and what they can do differently and not retaliate. So our violence interrupters here at Howard University are doing that work even today. And so that's just a beginning of the type of work that we're doing here at Howard.
Marcus, tell me more about these violence interrupters. Who are they? Where do they come from? How do you connect with them to get them to work with you, to work with Howard University? Who are these people?
You know, the best way to describe a violence interrupter is they are the subject matter expert. They are the doctors in their neighborhood. And not only are they the doctors, they know what to prescribe for their particular community. Violence intervention work is not a cookie cutter approach. What's needed in this neighborhood may not be the exact same thing that's needed in a neighborhood 0.3 miles away. These are the folks on the ground that would know that. They are community stakeholders. Oftentimes, they are part of our returning citizen population, folks who, through taught restorative justice practices, are now coming back to restore some of the damage they may have done in the past. They are graduates of college, right? They are folks that have invested in their education and now are coming back to give to their communities. They are the people with the unique ability and relationship to connect to a population that is often judged before they have a chance to speak.
But how do you find them? I mean, do you find them in court? Are you walking down the street? Are you because the reason I'm asking for these kind of specifics, because when I would know where to get a gun illegally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm not going to shoot anybody. Okay. Unless they try to break into my home. Mm-hmm. Okay. But we have seen what those of us with a level mindset, for lack of a better term, you know, observe these crimes that we hear about it, you know, in the news. It's just like the guy who got shot at Tony's place yesterday on 8th Street. From all accounts, the police say that this was a dispute. It may have been over the food.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot comprehend that, as even when my fries are cold, even when I ordered chicken and I got fish and I figure it out at home and I got to drive back to the carryout or to the restaurant, I'm not going to shoot anybody over that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but there are obviously people who are doing that. And so when we talk about these violence interrupters and all of the wonderful descriptions that you just shared, it, how does Marcus Ellis and the people that work with you find them?
So that's a great question. And really, that is the focal point of our partners. Peaceful DC partners with several community-based organizations that have a long-standing history of doing this work. They are the ones who work hard to identify the who. They don't just work hard to identify the who, they work hard to identify the who that is ready to take on this task, right?
And so they don't have to be convinced. They're already there.
There's a lot of that. There's the passion that comes with this work, and when you think about what you're literally dealing with death and dying on a daily basis. And so there's going to need to be a certain amount of passion and want to enter into this field, right? And so that's a huge part of how you do that identification. There are a plethora of organizations, again, doing the work, and they are the ones who are able to hone in on that skill set and bring these folks to the table.
Hold on one second, Roger. I got to go to the phone lines. Paul, calling from Capitol Heights, thank you for being patient. What's on your mind?
You talking to Paul?
Yes, sir. Go right ahead, please.
Okay, yes, sir. I want to throw this out there real quick. The RDAP program that's in the federal system, I really wish they can get that to the youth now before they even get to a prison.
The what program, Paul? What is it?
It's called RDAP.
Spell that, because I... Oh, gosh, we just lost Paul. Not familiar with that. My guests are quickly trying to Google that. If you guys find out about that, please let us know. Let's go to Colette calling from Suitland. Colette, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, what's on my mind? I wanted to speak on the violence that young people are committing, not just with guns, but all violence. I feel that the authorities need to allow these parents to start disciplining these kids at a young age and give them that old school whipping that we used to get. Because if they get that whipping, they'll think about some of the things they're going out here doing. But right now, parents are scared to even discipline their kids, because if, you know, they discipline them too hard, what they'll start saying is now parents are getting locked up for it. So parents are kind of scared to even discipline their kids. So I feel, like I said, authorities need to start giving these parents authority again. To start whipping these kids. And they'll think about some of the things that they're doing out here.
So Colette, thank you so much for your comment. And, you know, she makes an interesting point, because in these press conferences that we've seen with city leaders, county leaders, on one hand, we've been hearing a lot over the past, you know, couple of weeks about parents need to be held accountable. But like Colette said, parents who may try to be accountable may also find themselves, you know, facing charges for discipline. And that, and we could talk about the whole discipline thing for, we could do a series on discipline. But, you know, the bottom line is, if you spank them, they'll call Child Protective Services. But if your child goes out and commits a crime, we are beginning to slowly see a push that prosecutors want parents to be prosecuted for the crime, you know, because their children are committing crimes. It's like a catch-22.
Yeah, you know, her point is extremely valid, because all of the research shows that in violence prevention, the best programs are surrogate family structures, right? Create a family structure. So the discipline of a family is one of the greatest predictors of whether or not a young person will engage in violent behavior. And it's important to note that. Now, you know, in my home, I got three children. You know, we didn't put our hands on our children too much. But I got
wait a minute.
Yeah, wait, too much.
Not too much.
Not too much.
On a scale of 1 to 100.
1 to 100. It was about a 40. Right?
Oh, it was about a 40. Yeah. For me, it was about a 140. But go ahead.
Yeah, but you see what I'm saying? Is that discipline? Because when we make a decision as an adolescent, when you make a decision, you're in split seconds measuring what are you scared of, right? And when you're scared of your mother and your father more than anything, then your behavior is going to go along with that. And that becomes extremely important. So discipline in a household is extremely important. It's one of the first ways that violence can be prevented in communities, particularly our communities that may be disenfranchised. And so those families, and it's not just the parents, it's the grandparents, it's the coaches, it's the mentors. We know that type of work for young people, it works extremely well. That those types of relationship, violence prevention is a relational construct. That's why VIs work so well in when they work. One of the things that I wanted to come back to, you gave the example of a shooting, a spontaneous shooting out in front of a restaurant because of anger. Well, violence interrupters aren't going to solve that. Let me be clear. Violence interrupters may solve that the brother that just got shot and his boys want to come back and retaliate, but it won't stop that first one. That's why the gun laws are important, right? That's why you need a multidisciplinary approach to this prevention issue. It's not just one thing.
If I could, I love that you brought that incident back up, Doc, because what we know is that, and this is a conversation I have with my wife all the time about not blowing the horn at someone at a traffic light, because that horn blow triggers so much for someone who is dealing with things that have nothing to do with that horn being blown, right? And so just speaking about something that we instill into our violence interrupters by the name of CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, and this is a practice of managing your problems by changing the way you think and behave. It's most commonly used to treat anxiety and depression. But it helps that thinking process, because trust me, it's never really over the fries, right? It's not over the cold food. It's not that. There's built up.
That's right.
We're looking at a time throughout our nation, not just the District of Columbia, where homicides went up during COVID. When we were supposed to be on lockdown and everyone was supposed to be in the house, nationally, the numbers of homicides rose. And so that lets you know that this is deeper. We're unpeeling things that are root cause, right? And trying to really get in front of what could happen next, but also stop what has been happening as well.
Let me go back to the phone lines. We got Paul back. Paul, don't know what happened, but I'm glad you're back on the line. You were talking about a program.
Yes.
What now? Can you spell that? Because I'm not clear.
It's RDAP.
RDAT. RDAT.
Yes, it's a federal funded program. And you take this program when you go to the Fed. And it makes you look at yourself. It helps you think about your actions before the action takes place. It shows you rational thinking, irrational thinking, cognition. It helps you with all those tools that you didn't have growing up. It pretty much makes you hold yourself accountable on everything you do.
Paul, thank you so much. Thank you so much for your input. Let's go to Walter, calling from Maryland. Walter, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm good. Go ahead.
You know, I think a lot of it, I heard Dr. Mitchell speak about it earlier. One of the people calling talked about it also. But one of the things that we've got now, have all the programs that we course solve problems, pandemic. Now, once we had this pandemic and we had all of these children not in school, at home all day, you know, not being held accountable, but that we have a mental health problem. We talk so much about the symptoms of that. We have a mass mental health pandemic going on now. We talk about the amount of bullets and the amount of guns on the street, things like that. Yes, we need to deal with all of that. But we have a massive mental health pandemic going on. There's, you know, no reason why, you know, 20-year-old to keep thinking that it's okay to walk around with a pistol to begin with. Now, let alone shoot somebody. And walking around with this in your hand to start with. This mental health problem is very significant, and we need to start looking at mental health the way we look at other health problems.
Walter, you're breaking up a bit, but I did get your point when you were saying that, you know, you may have a 20-year-old who thinks it's okay to walk around, you know, with a gun. I thank you so much. I have to give him some pushback because you can do that in Florida. You can do that in Texas, okay? At 18 in Texas, you can walk around with a gun. We just saw up in Montgomery County a guy with an AR protesting by a child's bus stop. With an AR style, protesting the new gun restrictions in the state of Maryland. He didn't hurt anybody, but I would say that if I was standing at a bus stop, whether it be in the suburbs or in the inner city or someplace in between, and some guy's walking around with an AR style gun and I'm in elementary school, I'm scared to death.
Yeah,
and so I think that he's right. It is a mental health thing, but it is a gun thing, and I don't think we're going to resolve the gun thing because if you know we have restrictions here in the District of Columbia that they don't have in Virginia. We have, it's a free for all in Texas, as I said. So, you know, I think it does go back to what you were saying. You know, about addressing, Marcus, the mental health issue. But what about the bigger societal issue? You talked, Roger, about disciplining your children. That's the stuff that, you know, you deal with when they're under the age of five. But if the parents or the guardians are not doing it, and we have these 11-year-olds and 12-year-olds and 15-year-olds running the street, threatening to or actually shooting people, Do you just give up on them?
No, I think, you know, there's so many, it's multidisciplinary, so many factors that lead to violence. Disciplining your children, you know, and being that example for your children and instilling, and someone talked about emphasis on spirituality as a mechanism by way that you can show the example to not use violence. All of those things are critical, right? And so if you have a parent that is unable to, you know, parent their child at 12 and 15, what are the barriers that parent is facing, right? So what are the things that parent doesn't have? Does a parent not have access to jobs? Is it, are they working too much? Now they have to work 2-3 jobs because of the economy of the ability to provide, and so now discipline is not there because the parent has to work. A great parent, you know, working 3 jobs to provide, but can't be there now as a grandparent or a cousin that has to take care of that child. So there's layers to this violence prevention, and that's why it's not just about the young person to be blamed. It's really about what is the larger societal support, the societal access that communities have and families have, so that their children and their own life being are not at risk for the effects of violence. There's an old African proverb that if a child does not feel the love of its village, then it will burn it down to feel its warmth, right? And so there is a need for us to look at all of these social determinants of health, right? Where we live, love, work, play, and have our being, and create levers in these areas to make sure that our families can thrive. Because violence is a symptom of the system. It's a problem to be solved, but it's a problem to be solved by dealing with the actual disease itself. And the disease itself is often inequities in community. And then the mental health piece is you know, I have 3 children, and COVID did a number on them. And, you know, all of my kids have displayed issues with stress and anxiety. And I say that with a badge of honor, because if you go through something that breaks your arm and it's broken, nobody says, why is your arm broke? Well, I just got hit with a bat in my arm. Mm-hmm. Of course it's going to be broken. COVID did a number on all of us. And to suggest that it didn't do a mental health number on us is a lie. And so the thing about it is, I have resources to be able to get my children support from a mental health provider, right? And so, you know, our VIs, and Marcus and I was talking a little bit earlier, even the VIs that Marcus works with and I work with, because I'm part of the faculty of that curriculum, they are even still unpacking some of their trauma, because that trauma is leading to how people behave. And, that trauma is critically important to understand in how we deal with our behaviors surrounding violence.
Is it difficult, Marcus, to talk to members of the community who are struggling when it's not just the effects of the pandemic, it's not just the effects of poverty, but even in some cases, and I think, you know, Roger just alluded to this, but it is even an issue of class. Because if I know that there are some communities, many communities, where there is a cycle of intellectual poverty. There is a cycle of a poverty of familial resources, where you have generations of families who, in raising their children, only know one way that has a deleterious effect on them. And so when they come out, they're mad because mama's mad, because mama's mama was mad, because grandmama's mama was mad. How do you break that cycle? Because eventually one of those children whose mother was mad, whose grandmother was mad, will get his or her hand on a gun.
And Howard, can I just add one thing on that? Is that grandmama and great-grandmama that was mad, they were a slave being whipped by the master.
Okay.
Because institutional structural racism has to be at, when you go far that back, and that cycle of poverty, and that cycle of what you're describing, has a connection in the U.S., in our community, with institutional structural racism. I just wanted to make sure that we ended where that started, so that we don't further blame, you know, even though it is behavior and we make choices, make sure that we understand where some of this really started.
But to that point, and I do want to hear from you, Marcus, but to that point, like you said, your children were affected by the pandemic, but you had resources.
That's right.
And you also knew that you had resources. And if you didn't have resources, you knew where to go. And you knew that even through your frustration, that you also knew you got a PhD. Okay. You know, you work at Howard University, the Mecca. But we're talking about families that know nothing about the kind of resources.
Absolutely.
And that's where I talk about a separation of class even within our community. So when in some cases, when a Dr. Roger Mitchell comes to talk to these people who are affected, they may look at you like you have three heads because they don't know what you're talking about. How do you deal with that?
Yeah.
That cycle.
I think that, I mean, some of that, and even with Doc, I always talk about relationships and, like, you know, people being familiar with the story, right? And the thing that I think...
The violence interrupters again.
Yeah, and I think that even in what I'll call an executive level, the one thing that we also even share in our stories is that this didn't happen, right, overnight. There's a huge history to how our transition into this particular space, right? And so I think the other thing I'll look at, Doc, you touched a lot on, you know, in terms of when we're talking about the parents and things of that nature, right? I used to oversee D.C.'s long-term juvenile detention center.
Mm-hmm.
4 years there, 98% of my youth that were incarcerated were black. Does that mean that white kids weren't committing crimes? No, it doesn't. It means that we're going back to a resource that our kids did not have, right? And so now they're in a system. And that system that, you know, we can go back to mass incarceration and the fact that a lot of our fathers were not in the home. We often hear the conversation around, you know, holding the parent accountable. But Doc kind of touched on it. The dad, you know, is not in the home. And then we have a mom who's pulling the two jobs. I saw this over and over again from previous work. That sixth grader now has a decision to make. I'm either going to go, you know, fourth, seventh, eighth, ninth grade and get my education, or I just became the man of the household and I got to figure this thing out. So I agree with what you're saying in terms of the separation of class, the lack of opportunity, whether that be educational or financial, whether we're talking about discrepancies in terms of the food that's available in certain neighborhoods, as we talk about food deserts. This is an entire and a huge problem that has several different facets to it. And just like we didn't get here overnight, we're asking a lot of times for the time for a different way of solving this issue to be given, right? Don't look at this and say it's not working. That VI thing, nah, let's go back to arrest, right? We didn't get here overnight. We're not going to fix this overnight, so we need the time to implement these strategies.
Mm-hmm. Roger, I'll let you have a final thought.
So tomorrow's Wear Orange.
Yeah.
Want to invite everybody out to Howard University's hospital in front, right there in the mezzanine, in front of the flagpole. We're going to have a moment of silence there at 9:30 a.m. So if you want to come out and commemorate the end gun violence in a visual way. Also, the Trigger Project, which is a violence prevention project here in the city, is having their end gun violence festival it at Freedom Plaza tomorrow. That starts around noon. So you want to be involved there. And you know, there's opportunities for you to get involved. And I'll let Marcus talk about Peace Academy and Peace for DC. But just understand that we're developing violence prevention activities, and we want you to be involved as soon as possible.
Well, both of the information for Peace for DC will be on our website, as always, along with this particular conversation in a podcast after 8:30 tonight. But I want to thank both of you, Dr. Roger Mitchell and Marcus Ellis, for coming in and having this difficult, important conversation. And we need to keep talking. So,
thank you.
That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, June 1st. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.